This is Howard Husick, Vice President for Policy Research at the Manhattan Institute. I'm here with Jim Copeland, the Director of the Institute's Center for Legal Policy. He's the author of our new report, Trial Lawyers, Inc., K Street, a report on the litigation lobby, 2010. Jim, could you start by telling us about the Institute's Trial Lawyers, Inc. series?
Well, Howard, in 2003, the Center for Legal Policy published the first in a series now of reports entitled Trial Lawyers, Inc., or Trial Lawyers Incorporated. And the notion here was to capture a description of the litigation industry. Lawyers like to act as if they're just crusaders for the little guy who hang out their shingles and take cases as they come to them. But in fact, what we've seen, and this is something that was unprecedented in American history, or in Anglo-American history, actually, but over the last 50 or 60 years, we've seen the institutionalization of legal practice such that it runs like a business, like an industry. And that includes massive public relations and government relations efforts, the sort of lobbying efforts that we're talking about in this report.
And, of course, in our previous series, we've looked at how this trial lawyers industry has initiated class action suits of all types, asbestos, lead paint related. And now you've turned your attention to the relationship between this trial lawyers industry, as you're calling it, and the political system. Why don't you elucidate what that link is?
Well, it's a link that's essential for the trial lawyers as an industry. Each of these sorts of business lines we focused on previously, be it asbestos, be it tobacco, be it class actions, be it medical malpractice, they all are dependent on the courts. They're all dependent on the government. Unlike other types of businesses that are trying to sell you a product or sell you a service and therefore need a willing customer, trial lawyers have unique access to the government's monopoly on the use of force, and the courts redistribute wealth from defendants to plaintiffs. Now, we want the courts to do this if someone actually was injured and the defendant was actually an injurer causing the injury and was actually negligent or somehow liable in some way. So I don't mean to suggest that this system is somehow illegitimate on its face, but because the government is the fulcrum here, that's the courts and that's the legislatures who set policy, the trial bar has developed a very aggressive effort both to massage its media image and particularly to buy influence among politicians and among elected members of the judiciary, and many state court judges are elected, so that it continue to expand its business lines and protect its existing business lines, really to profit as a plaintiff's bar, as an aggressive industry that's using the courts to make a lot of money.
Right. So just to be plain, when you talk about business lines, you're talking about lawsuits against corporations for alleged wrongdoing that may be overstated, exaggerated, inappropriate.
Exactly. Some of our earlier reports in this series talked about, for instance, the asbestos litigation. Asbestos is a harmful substance. It was used widely in American industry earlier in the middle part of the 20th century and before, and it does cause lots of deaths. But what the trial bar has done is has created this sort of business model where they manufacture claims. They advertise on the internet, on television, on radio, on the subways to attract potential plaintiffs. And they sort of use these doctors that are under their employ to manufacture claims that often are not valid claims. So to sort of keep this going, they need to have judges, they need to have legislators in their pocket, more or less. And what we see is they actually transfer an enormous amount of wealth into the political process. Over just the last decade, lawyers and law firms, not counting lobbyists, have given $780 million directly to candidates in federal campaigns and $727 million to candidates in state campaigns.
Well, let me just get that straight. $780 million to federal campaign coffers and almost the same amount to state?
Exactly. And that doesn't even count independent expenditures when they're buying ads in some of these contested state races and what have you. That's just direct contributions. Nothing illegal about it. But the campaign finance laws that we have sort of perpetuate the strength of the trial bar, because we have donation limits of say, $2,000 or change at the federal level. And what the trial bar is able to do is bundle lots of donations among lots of lawyers that can give that type of check, and therefore concentrate their power at key junctures, the Senate leadership, the leadership of the U.S. Senate,
well, that's what
state
I
Supreme
to ask
Court
you. Who,
races.
Who really gets a lot of this money? Let's get right down to cases, Jim.
Well, when you look at it, if you look at the Senate leadership in particular, let's just take the federal level.
The U.S. Senate.
The United States Senate. For the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee in the last campaign, two of the five largest contributors were plaintiffs' law firms, a New York asbestos firm called Weitz & Luxembourg, and an Illinois asbestos firm called Cooney & Conway. If you look over the last 5 years, which is sort of a Senate election cycle, the two top Democrats, the leaders of the Senate, Harry Reid, the Democrat of Nevada, and Dick Durbin, the Democrat of Illinois, the majority leader and majority whip, respectively, their contributors have been dominated by plaintiffs' firms. Four of the top seven contributors to Harry Reid, the majority leader of the Senate, are out-of-state plaintiffs' firms. The top two contributors and seven of the top 20 donors to Dick Durbin, the majority whip of the Senate, are plaintiffs' law firms. So this is an overwhelming concentration of money flowing into the coffers of those who are really creating our federal legislative policy.
And what are they looking for in return?
Well, their objectives are both defensive and offensive. So defensively, we can see this in the recent debate over health care reform. Howard Dean, the former Democratic National Committee chairman, sort of admitted this fall in one of these town hall meetings that the reason there's no tort reform in the health care reform bills is because we don't want to upset the trial bar. And in fact, that's been the case. In both the Senate and House bill, there's no effort towards substantive tort reform. There have been a few things that are symbolic that are thrown in there, some of which would actually make matters worse. And some of the provisions would actually empower state attorneys general to file suit through contingent fee lawyers to enforce various provisions.
So you're talking about the health care reform bill that is still pending, not yet passed.
Exactly. And it may not pass. And some of their legislation hasn't passed, but they've gotten offensive legislation passed. The first bill signed by President Obama after his inauguration was the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which reversed a Supreme Court opinion and otherwise substantively expanded the scope of employment law, basically gutting the longstanding statutes of limitations that were in place for gender discrimination and other sorts of employment law cases, so that effectively discrimination that happened 20 years ago could result in a case being brought today. So it's a significant expansion of law. We've seen it in lots of other areas, and there's a lot of pending bills out there that they're floating. They're trying to cut a tax break, a $1.6 billion tax break to contingent fee lawyers based on the expensing of expenses in contingent fee litigation. They're assaulting arbitration contracts. They're trying to override the preemption that exists under federal law for certain congressional laws and regulations at the federal level and allow state juries effectively to override these federal prerogatives.
So these kind of details can be hard for people to grasp, but in a general way, you're saying, as I understand it, is that relatively arcane changes in federal law can invite legal action that is very remunerative for the trial bar. Is that basically it?
Precisely. It's very rewarding. Small changes in substantive law or small changes at the federal level in procedures, various procedures, rules of evidence, statutes of limitations, all these sorts of legal procedures can dramatically expand the profits of the plaintiff's bar. And it's important to understand why folks should really care about this. The United States has more litigation as a percentage of its economy than all of our friends in the developed world. It's over 2% of our gross domestic product goes just to the direct costs of tort litigation. That's not the indirect costs, foregone investment, research and development, defensive medicine expenses that filter throughout our healthcare system. That's just the direct expenses of tort litigation, and that's double what they have in Germany. It's triple what they have in England or France. So it's a very expensive cost on our economy, and we're not getting improved safety as a result of that. What we're getting are a lot of people afraid of lawsuits, spending money to avoid lawsuits, because the lawsuits often don't link up with actual injuries that are being caused through negligence on the part of defendants.
Well, and just one last thing, Jim. This Trial Lawyers, Inc. industry that you're talking about, do they do pretty well?
They do really well. The estimates are that they make more than the defense bar. But if you look at the total amount I was talking about, 2% of the economy, that's over $250 billion in this industry in terms of the dollars are changing hands. Now, that's not all going to the trial bar, but about one-fifth of it is. So the plaintiff's bar, not counting the defense lawyers, is bringing in about $50 billion a year. That's a lot of money. And that's why even though when they're spending over $1 billion on the political process, that's a small price to pay relative to the amount they're bringing home.
Thank you, Jim Copeland. He's the author of the Manhattan Institute Center for Legal Policy new report, Trial Lawyers, Inc., K Street. If you'd like to read Jim's report, go to www.triallawyersinc.com. I'm Howard Husick.